South Koreans obviously came away from the entire drama in Hanoi probably in the worst position of everyone.
That is one of the reasons the South Korean president travels to Washington. This is Thursday, April 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the wait is on for South Korea's high court to weigh in on the question of abortion. The terrorist mass murder in New Zealand has led to questions in Washington for social media companies. And scientists say black holes in the universe are real and they can now prove it. Hear it all on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is headed to Washington, where he'll meet with U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday. Moon had said previously he hoped his trip to the United States would revitalize stalled talks with North Korea that collapsed after Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un failed to reach an agreement during their February summit in Hanoi. Joining us is Evans Revere. He's a senior advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. He served as one of the State Department's top Asia experts, serving as acting assistant secretary of state for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and principal deputy assistant secretary managing U.S. relations with the Asia-Pacific region. Evans, thanks so much for being with us. What I said that Moon was looking for, is he going to be able to get that done?
Well, that is certainly the question of the hour, isn't it? He has his work cut out for him, President Moon does. He either needs to convince President Trump that the approach that President Trump adopted at the Hanoi summit needs to be revised, and the president needs to walk back from that approach and consider something less demanding of the North Koreans. Or alternatively, he needs to convince the president that Kim Jong-un is prepared to walk back from the approach that he adopted at the summit in Hanoi. Either way, President Moon has his work cut out for him, and I suspect there will be little appetite in Washington for a major revision of the U.S. position.
Now, that revision, I would imagine, involves by a pretty big percentage the removal of sanctions against North Korea, and there doesn't seem to be much movement, especially there. Is that correct?
That's correct. And even more problematically, there are reports coming out of Seoul that seem quite credible that one of the arguments, one of the cases that President Moon will make to President Trump is that a new approach needs to focus on easing sanctions, removing sanctions on North Korea, which, of course, is the polar opposite of the position that President Trump and his team took during the summit in Hanoi.
Well, the U.S. position seems to be clear that there will be no removal or even lessening of sanctions without a complete stop to the North Korean nuclear program. Is that ever going to take place?
It's hard to imagine, based on the North Korean position that was laid out in Hanoi, but also the statements that we've heard from Kim Jong-un and other senior officials in his regime, a series of speeches and talks and directives that have come from Kim Jong-un. All of these things have pointed to North Korea's determination to retain its nuclear weapons program, and certainly the core elements of its nuclear weapons program. And if you look back at the position that Kim Jong-un took in Hanoi at the summit, what he was basically presenting to the United States was a minimal, partial effort to denuclearize while retaining all of the elements, the core elements of his nuclear weapons program, in return for the complete removal of U.S. sanctions. That didn't fly then. I don't think it's going to fly now. But importantly, what I think the president and his team learned in Hanoi was how determined North Korea is to hold on to those elements of its nuclear weapons program.
Why is that?
It's their insurance policy. It's the one thing that they have that they can use as a bargaining chip if they choose to do so. But more importantly, it's the thing that the regime and Kim Jong-un himself relies upon to preserve his regime against what they fear is a U.S. attack someday, a U.S. blackmail someday, U.S. aggression someday. And this is, as I said at the outset of this paragraph, this is his insurance policy, and he's not about to give that up.
Are there any options that you see open to South Korea?
The South Koreans obviously came away from the entire drama in Hanoi probably in the worst position of everyone. The Chinese are rather happy that there's no testing going on, as is the United States. The Chinese are also happy that the United States has been ramping down its military exercises, terminating some and scaling back others. China is also happy that there seems to be some friction between Seoul and Washington. North Korea, even though they may have been somewhat disappointed that they didn't get the sanctions removed, they're happy because they are able now to continue producing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, even without testing. The United States, I think President Trump is happy by his own admission. The North Koreans are not testing. And so the person who gets left holding the bag, if you will, is President Moon in South Korea, because he was anticipating a major breakthrough in Hanoi, which didn't happen, that could have led to the elimination of some significant sanctions and obstacles to his game plan, which is to expand economic relations between North and South. And that did not happen and is not happening. So his options now are to try to convince either President Trump or Kim Jong-un to step away from the position that they took in Hanoi and adopt a more flexible approach to things.
Evans Revere is a senior advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Evans, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. The search continues for the pilot of a Japanese F-35 fighter jet that crashed in the Pacific Ocean Tuesday night off the east coast of Aomori. At least three people are dead, seven others injured in a fire at a major shopping mall in Bangkok. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang meets his Croatian counterpart in Zagreb as he begins his official visit to the country. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen says her country seeks closer economic relations with the United States through a bilateral trade agreement as it looks to reduce its economic reliance on its largest trading partner, China. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and at voanews.com. Thank you for being with us at VOA Asia. South Korea's top court is expected to respond soon to a petition asking it to declare the country's criminal ban on abortions unconstitutional. Voices are passionate on both sides of the debate, as Kurt Aitchen reports from Seoul.
These South Korean women hold a quiet daily vigil in front of the country's constitutional court in central Seoul. The court is set to rule this week on whether to uphold or overturn South Korea's criminalization of abortion. The women vehemently support keeping the ban in place.
We have been protesting here since June last year, so it's been more than 10 months now. We are not an organized group, but individually we come out here, hold petition campaigns, and work to spread the word via social media. Still, we have no way of knowing what the court decision will be.
Religious groups and conservatives support South Korea's current legal structure, in which a woman who terminates a pregnancy on her own with drugs or other measures can be sentenced to up to 1 year in prison or fined up to 2 million won, about $1,700. Doctors who facilitate an abortion could face up to 2 years in prison. Supporters of overturning the law and decriminalizing abortion are vocal, holding what have come to be known as red and black protests.
Red and black are symbolic colors. Koreans have worn black since 2010 to demand abortion rights in solidarity with similar protest groups in Poland and other countries. We also display red color to send a warning to the court that criminalization of abortion is against the Constitution, and we're calling on members of the court to rule to that effect.
The abortion debate is every bit as sensitive in South Korea as it is elsewhere, with all of the same moral and ethical dimensions other countries confront. But here, there is the added complication of a demographic crisis. The government is struggling to counter a plummeting birth rate stemming from a changing economy and from educated young women making new choices about their bodies, their careers, and their future. Supporters of overturning the abortion ban say the current law reflects a long-standing tone deafness by the government toward women and their right to self-determination. Women are not wombs is a common slogan at their events. It will take 6 of the 9 judges on South Korea's constitutional court to decide whether it's time for a change and whether criminalization of abortion should be relegated to the history books. Kurt Asian for VOA News, Seoul.
Happening now in Asia, India went on high security alert Wednesday ahead of the start of its marathon election after a campaign dominated by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's leadership that's focused on keeping the country safe from attack. A bomb blast Tuesday blamed on Maoist rebels killed 5, including a lawmaker campaigning for Mr. Modi. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. The live stream video of the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shooting last month highlighted the continuing struggle by social media companies to police extremist content on their platforms. Facebook and Google representatives told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday that the effort to balance free speech with oversight of white supremacist content is ongoing. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
A church, a synagogue, and a mosque. Attacks inspired by white supremacist ideology fostered on social media.
In the age of instant communication with worldwide reach, white nationalist groups target communities of color and religious minorities through social media platforms.
Since 2007, right-wing extremist attacks have taken place across the nation. But the problem is global. And the live stream of the New Zealand shooting posed a massive challenge.
We actually prevented 1.2 million and were able to find 300,000 additional uploads of that video within the first 24 hours and had a very forceful and swift response.
The decision to remove videos of mass shootings is clear-cut. Policing the free speech of more than 2 billion people is far more complex.
Hate speech, because it often relies on spoken rather than visual cues, is sometimes harder to detect than some forms of branded terrorist propaganda. It's intensely context-specific, and it can be contentious, as there is often disagreement on what could be considered political speech. On the opposite end, over-aggressive enforcement can also inadvertently silence voices that are using the platform to make themselves heard on these important issues.
Social media companies are protected by law from liability for content posted on their platforms.
This is a piece of legislation that really allows the internet as we understand it to exist. And fiddling with it on the edges could, I think, have a really bad implications for customers who enjoy using these services. Because what will happen is if they amend legislation to actually make Facebook, Twitter, YouTube liable for extremist content, say, you run the risk of overreaction. And Facebook and Twitter will be they'll shut down tons and tons and tons of channels and content.
White supremacy has never been allowed on Facebook, but recently the company expanded the scope of the ban, redirecting users to a nonprofit that helps people leave hate groups.
We extended that policy to include a ban on all praise, support, and representation of white nationalism and white separatism. We see these ideologies as being inextricably linked to supremacy with intensive violence more generally.
President Trump's rhetoric about immigrants and his reaction in the aftermath of the deadly 2017 Charlottesville rally encourages hate speech, say Democrats. The president denies this, and the danger of white supremacy was acknowledged just last week by the nation's top law enforcement official.
We assess that it's a persistent, pervasive threat.
This just illustrates part of the problem.
A problem so immediate that racist content flooding the YouTube live stream of the hearing shut the comments section down. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Coming up, we now know what a black hole looks like. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more.
broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Arakan Army rebels overran a police base in Rakhine State, killing two officers and one of their wives, according to the Myanmar government, it said on Wednesday. As fresh fighting broke out at an historic Buddhist temple town popular with tourists. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and to share. This is VOA Asia. We continue with Silicon Valley coding prodigy, 10 years old, who's been coding since the age of six, has created two new board games to teach other kids to code. VOA's Deanna Mitchell reports from Santa Clara, California.
Samira Mehta is not your average 10-year-old. She's been coding since age six and is into artificial intelligence. In fact, she's so passionate about these topics that she wants to share the love. She's created two board games in hopes that other kids, especially girls, will catch the tech bug.
Color Bunnies, it will teach you all the concepts you ever need in computer programming. From the very basics like sequencing, conditionals, and debugging, to more advanced computer programming concepts. Coder Minds is the first artificial intelligence board game ever created. We're setting up by arranging them in piles.
Mehta was born into the tech world. Her dad, who works in artificial intelligence at Intel, first got her interested in coding when she was just 6 years old.
He showed me one button on his computer which said, "Press this if you're beautiful." But then when my mouse pointer touched the "You are beautiful" command, it just disappeared. I was like, "Wait, how did you do that?" And they got me really involved in coding.
I think there's a lot of passion and enthusiasm in this girl, and she wants to make a difference, and that is coming from the heart.
Mehta particularly hopes to inspire other girls.
And I believe that girls are underrepresented, especially in this computer science and technology field.
She has held coding workshops for kids at local libraries, Google, Microsoft, and Intel. Her ambitions have even gotten her face-to-face with Mark Zuckerberg, using a strategy only a kid could pull off.
I was actually handing out the candy on Halloween when we went to his house. So we talked for a little while.
She's already made more than $200,000 worldwide from her board games and has started a girls' initiative called Girls You Code. So what's next?
I like coding and I like artificial intelligence, and I want to use it to do good to others.
Seems like this trailblazer is on the right path. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Santa Clara, California.
Here's a news alert from VOA Asia. Sri Lanka's former defense secretary, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who oversaw the crushing of Tamil Tiger rebels under his brother Mahinda Rajapaksa's rule a decade ago, is being sued in two cases in the United States for his alleged role in torture and murder. That according to a lawyer and court documents. This is VOA Asia. A new report out finds gender inequality strips women of their ability to control their sexual and reproductive options and limits their right to choose when and if they wish to start a family. The United Nations Population Fund has released this year's State of the World Population Report entitled Unfinished Business, The Pursuit of Rights and Choices for All. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Big gains have been made in reproductive rights over the past 50 years when the United Nations Population Fund was created. The number of births per woman has dropped by nearly half to 2.5 births. There's been a significant decrease in fertility rates in the least developed countries, as well as deaths from pregnancy-related causes. But the UNFPA reports more than 200 million women are subjected to unwanted pregnancies because they have no access to modern contraceptives. It says more than 800 women die every day from preventable preventable causes during pregnancy and childbirth because many are unable to access reproductive health services. Director of UNFPA in Geneva, Monica Farrow, says gender inequality is the obstacle that underpins all others. She says gender unequal norms and attitudes are often used to control women's sexuality and reproduction.
Gender inequality limits the ability of women to freely make fundamental decisions about when and with whom to have sex, about the use of contraception or health care, and about whether and when to seek employment or whether to seek higher education.
The report says hundreds of millions of women worldwide are being left behind, unable to enjoy their rights to sexual and reproductive health. It says these women and girls typically are poorer, rural, and less educated. It says two-thirds of maternal deaths today occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Farrow tells VOA women fare best in countries that have invested most in gender equality policies and programs. Most of these countries are in the developed world.
If you look at the countries who are the most challenged ones, it's countries where women still face many barriers in accessing health, in accessing especially sexual reproductive health and rights. And this has to do also with specific challenges, be it specific economic crisis, shortfalls.
The UNFPA has set itself several ambitious goals, timed to meet the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030. These include the elimination of preventable maternal deaths, creating universal access to family planning, and achieving zero tolerance for violent and abusive practices that harm women and girls. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia. An international team of scientists gathered around the world Wednesday to simultaneously reveal the first ever picture of a black hole, a celestial body considered so dense that even light itself cannot escape its gravitational pull. Scientists in Washington joined colleagues in Brussels, Santiago, Shanghai, Taipei, and Tokyo to disclose the groundbreaking result from the Event Horizon Telescope Project, an international collaboration begun in 2012 to directly observe a black hole using a global network of telescopes and international cooperation of more than 200 researchers. Astrophysicist and Event Horizon director Shepard Dolman unveiled the images in Washington. He said the picture is of a black hole at the center of a galaxy 55 million light years away. He says being able to take a picture and observe a black hole allows scientists to confirm many things that up to now were only theories.
We now know that a black hole that weighs 6.5 billion times what our sun does exists in the center of M87. And this is the strongest evidence that we have to date for the existence of black holes. And it is also consistent, the shape of this shadow, to the precision of our measurements with Einstein's predictions. The bright patch in the south that you see tells us that material moving around the black hole is moving at light speeds, which is also consistent with our simulations and predictions.
Black holes are thought to evolve at the end of the lifetime of a star when it collapses in upon itself to create a super-dense object with gravity so powerful that stars, planets, and even light itself cannot escape its pull. With this technology from the Event Horizon Telescope Project, Dolman said scientists now have a way to study black holes and their impact on the universe. This is VOA Asia.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of planetary scientists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, completed an analysis of metallic or M-type asteroids. Their findings led them to propose that some of the solar system's metallic asteroids may have had volcanoes that erupted with liquid iron after its crust had cooled and solidified shortly after their creation. The scientists say that these metallic asteroids were formed quite early in the solar system's history during the early stages of planet formation. It's thought that any serious collision between these developing planets would peel away their rocky outer layers, leaving behind its liquid iron core floating in space. The scientists say they were prompted to conduct their study in part by NASA's proposed 2022 launch of a probe that will investigate Psyche, the solar system's largest metallic asteroid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thanks for being with us on VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and we'd love to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, the managing editor, Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.